Our next guest, a terrifically talented writer for the Boston Globe, the author of books like The Blueprint, How the New England Patriots Beat the System to Create the Last Great NFL Superpower, Drive for Five, the remarkable run of the 2016 Patriots, and his wonderful new book, Bleeding Green, A History of the Hartford Whalers, Christopher Price joins us. Chris, good afternoon.
I love it, my friend. I love to hear that sound. I love talking to you, too, as well. But that's tremendous. Love that intro.
Well, I loved reading the book. It was such a great ride, and I got the distinct impression that, yes, it was a lot of work. Obviously, an incredibly well-researched book, but this had to be a labor of love for you.
It really was. I had a chance to talk to almost 100 different people when it came to researching this, and it was a kick talking to everybody, but at the same time, for a kid who grew up in Connecticut, for Ron Francis and Kevin Dineen and Mike Lee and the rest of them, it was really special. This really, for me, was the most personal book I've ever done, at least when you stack up, you know, the ones I've done before, maybe Baseball by the Beach, because I do have such a connection to baseball in Cape Cod. But this really, for me, was a special project, and like you said, it really was a labor of love.
What is it about the Whalers that captured the hearts of so many people, not just in Connecticut, but throughout New England?
Well, I think one of the important things to remember, Rich, is in Connecticut for an awful long time, there was no singular sporting identity that belonged just to the state. It was carved up. It was, you know, the sports version of the DMZ. You're either a Red Sox fan or a Yankees fan, a Bruins fan or a Rangers fan, and then when big-time hockey came to town, it was the first time that we had a real sense of possession when it came to big-time sports. This was, of course, before UConn basketball became the all-consuming sporting monolith that it is now. So it was really great for those of us who live in Connecticut to have some sort of big-time sports with some sort of possession about it. These guys were our guys. This was our team for the first time, and a lot of people really took them to heart.
Howard Baldwin is such an important player in this story, and would the Whalers have happened without him and his vision?
No, he really wouldn't have. And I love the comment. I think it was from a Hartford Current sports writer, Don Lamore, who called him really Henry Hill, you know, from the Music Man, who was just leading the parade down Asylum Street, like, look, we're going to have big-time hockey in town, and everyone's going to love it. And, he this is a guy who worked tirelessly not only to bring the WHA to Hartford, but to lead the charge when it came to the merger in the late 70s. You cannot tell the story of the Hartford Whalers without a guy like Howard Baldwin. He sacrificed an awful lot, to be able to have the franchise survive and thrive for a time in the state of Connecticut.
And Jack Kelly's approach was so unique, too, and you write about how others around the league maybe raised an eyebrow when he signed a lot of former Boston area college players, but it worked.
Yeah, the way they went about team building I thought was fascinating, because the WHA all of a sudden was flush with money, and all of us, these different teams were, looking for big time free agents, and Winnipeg went after Bobby Hull, and Philadelphia went after Derek Sanderson, and with the idea of luring talent to the NHL, but he took a very steady, consistent path and said, look, we're going to build a championship team. We're going to get good players, but we're not going to overreach. And so I think that was one of the reasons that the Whalers were so financially stable, when compared to some of the other teams that, who were in for a half a year and dropped out. The way he went about charting that course for that franchise, at least from an on-ice perspective, and you compare it to Howard Baldwin's passion, it really set the table for them to have an awful lot of success in the early going.
We've seen in recent years so many attempts at new sporting leagues, particularly in football, try and fail. And it's so interesting to note that, first of all, as you point out in the book, it was a lot cheaper to get involved back in the early 70s. But here was the WHA starting out and having success, so all while the American Basketball Association was also doing pretty well.
Yeah, I love that, man. I love the idea, and I know it's a different world today, and there's different, rules and regulations in place, and, antitrust exemptions and all that, but I love the idea of just saying, let's start a league. Let's pick it, let's find 10 like-minded individuals with a few bucks to them, and let's just go out and create a rival league, and the guys in the WHA, and Gary Davidson and Murphy were able to find those guys and to mount a real challenge at a time when the National Hockey League was a little bit vulnerable, quite frankly. They were entrenched in a lot of old school ways, in the WHA and the EABA, for that matter, had an awful lot of fun. And they were able to reach a new audience and kind of draw in new fans. And I'm glad that both the NBA and the NHL recognized that and eventually incorporated those teams into their league.
We're talking with Christopher Price about his new book, Bleeding Green, A History of the Hartford Whalers. And that history began as, of course, the New England Whalers trying to find a place to play, battling with the Bruins over use of the Garden, and then the decision made to move to Hartford. And I feel like that move really sealed their legacy.
Yeah, it really did. There were a couple of different options for them when it was clear that they needed to get out of Boston. The Bruins gave them, you know, lousy nights. They were playing on Sunday afternoons and Monday nights and just, you know, the worst possible times. And they had a few different possibilities, including Providence, and that fell through. And, you know, they looked at some other possibilities, but Hartford was just a natural fit for them for a few reasons, not the least of which, like I said before, they wanted big-time sports. They had just built the old Hartford Civic Center, and you know, they were able to get the corporate backing of places like Aetna that were, you know, really financially sound. And so the move really made an awful lot of sense for them. It's interesting talking to people and telling them, you know, they spent a year in the Boston Garden before they ended up moving to, you know, the Hartford Civic Center. And again, you know, they were the New England Whalers for an awful long time until they kind of narrowed that focus before the move to the NHL.
I love the story of how a lot of people in other venues, other cities around the country, sort of made fun of hockey in a mall, but it proved to be incredibly successful, not only in marketing merchandise that's continued to be popular for all these years, but you pointed out, too, that families felt very comfortable dropping off their youngsters at the Hartford Civic Center and knowing they'd be in a safe environment and a very different one than the old Boston Garden.
Exactly. Yeah. And look, I know it's a different era. And, you know, 30, 40 years ago, you know, things change an awful lot. But at the same time, you could drop your son or daughter off at the mall and say, look, you know, meet me right here after the game. And they'd be inside a kind of a contained building. They would be in the mall. They would be in a mall. And, it, you know, I remember my parents would do the same thing. They would drop me at the mall, and my friends and I would go upstairs to Wendy's. We would get chili, and we would spend $10 on tickets and sit in the nosebleeds. And, you know, it was a situation in an environment that allowed young fans to really flourish. You know, you look at some of the other things in addition to the fact that, you know, they played in a family-friendly atmosphere. You know, you look at the fact that, you know, they had Pucky the Whale, you know, before they had the classic logo that they had. It was a family-friendly logo. You know, it was a family-friendly environment. You know, it was a beautiful, clean building in the downtown section of a city that, you know, that was a nice place to go. So they had an awful lot of things going for them when it came to marketing for younger kids and families, and that certainly was one of them.
And we played Brass Bonanza coming into the conversation, and that's a big part of the story as well. And so many players who reflected back on what that meant to them, how, you know, maybe a little annoyed with it at first, but what it means these days to them.
Exactly. Yeah, my favorite story, Rich, was in the early 1980s when the team wasn't very good, and this was before Mark Howe was traded to Philadelphia. He said that he and his sons, you know, they got a copy of the record, and they would play sock hockey in the living room at home, and, you know, whenever someone scored a goal, they'd play the song. And he said, look, I came to love the song. I heard it more at home than I did at the rink, but, you know, I came to love the song. My other favorite story with the song was Kevin Dineen was coaching a couple of years ago in Switzerland, and they were at the top of a mountain. It was in Davos or something. And, you know, they were in a restaurant, and there was a guy across the restaurant who had a Whaler sweater. And he recognized Dineen, and, you know, Dineen, they kind of made eye contact. And after they were done with their meal, Dineen went over to him and, you know, just say hello. And the guy clearly couldn't speak a lick of English, but he started humming Brass Bonanza. And Kevin said, you know, when you have Brass Bonanza, you don't need a translator. So I think it's one of those things that continues to resonate with people. It's the song, it's the logo. It's certainly the nostalgic aspect of the whole thing. I think that kind of hits people in their sweet spot. But, you know, you can't discount the impact of something like that song and that logo, especially today.
One of the high water marks in the history of the Whalers was the signing of, well, all three Howes. Actually, as you point out, four Howes, because Colleen Howe was crucial to getting them all to Hartford.
Yeah, she really was. She was very unique. You know, she was a very powerful woman in an era where that was a rarity in the world of professional hockey, the world of professional sports, quite frankly. But she was in charge of their destiny, and I thought it was really interesting talking to Mark Howe that, look, he could have gone somewhere else when the merger happened, and it would have meant the end of his father's career, because his father was like, look, the only reason I'm not the only reason, but the major reason I'm playing at this point is because I want to play with my sons, Mark and Marty. And Mark was coveted by a number of National Hockey League teams, but the Whalers held his rights. And so the thinking was, look, we go to the NHL, Mark could very well go off to another team, but they kept him in Hartford. Gordy kept playing, and it was really fascinating to see the growth and the evolution of the Whalers as it relates to the Howe family, because the Whalers in the early days didn't really go for an awful lot of kind of bells and whistles, kind of cheap promotional gimmicks. But, you know, you could sell the fact that, look, come see Gordy Howe, come see his sons play. And that worked with an awful lot of people. I love the fact also the first year that they were in the NHL, at one point they had Gordy Howe, who was over 40. They had Dave Keon, who was over 40. Mm. The end of Bobby Hull's career. So they had Bobby Hull on the roster as well. They ended up having four guys who were in the Hockey Hall of Fame on that roster that first year in the National Hockey League.
Now, it all could have gone south when the old Hartford Civic Center collapsed, and yet they were able to not only come back but thrive even more, spent some time in Springfield. And I thought the incredible level of innovation to create something out of that, like the 91 Club.
Yeah, it was great. They immediately said, look, you know, we're going to move into the Springfield Civic Center, but at the same time, we're going to reward our fans. We're going to make it a point to reward our fans who have to take 91 North from Hartford up to Springfield for these games. And so they created this 91 Club, and Gordy Howe was the quote-unquote, you know, president. But you would get, you know, special promotional stuff, and you got a special, not a plaque, but you got a special certificate. And one of the great things was it allowed them to be able to kind of spread hockey goodwill throughout the state of Connecticut. You know, if they wouldn't maybe necessarily have done this before. Jordy Douglas tells a great story about how they would stop at a Wendy's back and forth between Hartford and Springfield. And, you know, in their practice gear, that, you know, you'd be sitting at Wendy's having a Frosty, and all of a sudden Gordy Howe and, you know, the Whalers would walk in for some lunch. And so it was a great way to kind of, again, spread some of that hockey hospitality and kind of reel people into Hartford. But, yeah, I think really when you talk about the collapse of the building, and I know I was trying to think, Rich, the other day, that is there a comparable situation where you had a team, you had a community, you had fans, you had everyone working together to kind of try to make something out of an awful situation. And the only thing that I can even think of that's anywhere remotely is what New Orleans had with the Superdome.
Right.
And the way that the community in Connecticut came together, the politicians, the fans, the team, to make it work, to build the new building, really, in hindsight, was really remarkable.
Chris, is there anybody who represented what the Whalers were all about, both on the ice and off, any better than Ron Francis?
No, it really, really not, Rich. I think that when you talk about the Whalers, again, you know, you mentioned Howard Baldwin. You can't tell the story of the Whalers without Howard Baldwin. Ron Francis was the closest thing they got to a superstar because, as I wrote, you know, write in the book, that he's a guy who could, you know, go to a community event in the afternoon and raise thousands of dollars for a charity and then score three goals against the Bruins at night and then talk to the media afterward and always say the right thing. He always said the right thing. He always did the right thing. He was the kind of guy who you could hitch your wagon to because he would never, ever disappoint you. And when they traded him to Pittsburgh in March of 1991, that really, for me, is the pivot point for the history of the franchise, because you could trace everything back to that. And it wasn't the only reason that they ended up moving 6 years later, but that and a series of other events led to them kind of packing up and moving to Carolina. So, yeah, ultimately, to answer your question, Ron Francis was the biggest star in the history of the Hartford Whalers.
And in terms of seeing them move on 6 years later, was the biggest impact the rise of UConn basketball?
Yeah, I think that fed into it. I think the fact that, you know, the NHL really didn't want a team there, you know, and under the guise of saying, look, we're going to try and grow the game, and so we're going to try and, you know, open up some warm weather markets, and they identified the Whalers, I think, as a particularly vulnerable franchise. So they said, look, we're going to move the team there. But, you know, the rise of UConn basketball, and again, if you're an advertiser who wants to put their money with a winner, you look at UConn basketball in the early 90s and you look at the Hartford Whalers in the early 90s, you clearly see UConn basketball on the ascent. And I'm going to say, look, all right, I'm going to move my advertising money from Hartford Whalers hockey, you know, a team that's all of a sudden missing the playoffs, to UConn basketball, men's and women's, you know, two programs that are clearly on the rise, aiming toward national championships. So I think that goes into the conversation. That's certainly one of the conversations. Really, ultimately, they picked the worst possible time to kind of start to backslide toward mediocrity.
Well, the Whale have left an incredible legacy. You talk about the number of coaches and GMs who are Whalers alums, but the love of this team from the fans that continues today. How do you explain that enduring connection with this team?
They have a stickiness in terms of marketing that can't be beaten. You know, they moved 25 years ago, and you can still go to the annual reunion that the Hartford Yard Goats minor league baseball team has every July, and 30 guys show up, and thousands of people come back to get autographs and talk with these former players and reminisce. I don't know of any other former franchise. I know of individuals, but I don't know of any other former franchise that still has that collective hold on a city, on a region, like the Hartford Whalers do. Like I said, a lot of it goes back to that nostalgic aspect that guys like me loved when we were growing up. A lot of it is, the cheesy song, and a lot of it is the logo. But the connections that these people made, the fans, the players, it still resonates today for an awful lot of people. Howard Baldwin put it right. And, when this team was at its peak, they were the Green Bay Packers of hockey. They were a small market team that had an absolutely rabid fan base that wanted to see it succeed.
So many great stories in the book. I think my favorite might be then Bruins coach Terry O'Reilly beating up a car.
it's funny because, in the moment, in the late 80s, early 90s, it was one of the more underrated rivalries in the sport of hockey. But, it's kind of faded into obscurity a little bit. But the Whalers and the Bruins had a good rivalry for an extended period of time. And there was a game at the Hartford Civic Center where the Bruins team bus was blocked in by a car or two. And Terry O'Reilly, the Bruins had just lost. And Terry O'Reilly, of course, is not one not known for his mild manner or his even temper. He went out and he attacked the car, started beating up the car with a hockey stick. And so, he wasn't arrested, but he was charged. And that's just one aspect of what turned out to be a really good rivalry. I remember, one of the assistant equipment managers talking about, putting lunches or dinners on the, the opposing team bus and feeling mad that the other team went after, Ron Francis a little bit too much. So we took bites out of, a couple of apples that were in the bags. So, there were little things like that the whole way that really kind of added to what was really a fun rivalry. But yeah, that was one of the more memorable moments.
Well, it's such a wonderful book, looking back at a different time in the world of pro sports and an unbreakable connection between a city, a region, and a team. The book is called Bleeding Green, A History of the Hartford Whalers. Absolutely delightful book. Chris, thank you so much for talking with us today about it.
My pleasure, Rich. Take care, and we'll talk soon.